You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Rob.
Michael.
Dude, I miss you. Sometimes you're not on the show.
Well, I'm always on the show. Well, you're just not sometimes not here for intros.
Sometimes you're not here for intros. No, sometimes you're not here for an episode.
Yeah, but we haven't aired really many of those yet.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying that sometimes, you know, I miss you.
Well, I miss you too when I'm gone.
Is that true?
It is.
No, because you do really well over with Dax, and he's a great guy, and I love him to death. But like, that's a big show.
It's a big show,
and you're doing well. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited for you. I hope you don't forget about the little people here. Great show. We got this great week. Actually, it's Smallville week.
And we're gonna do 2 weeks of Smallville week.
Do we announce both episodes? Yeah.
Well, no. We'll announce that this week we've got Kristen tomorrow.
Yes, we do. We have Kristen Krug tomorrow. Today we have two guys that really gave me the biggest opportunity of my life, the creators of Smallville. They also created Into the Badlands, Shanghai Knights. I mean, the list goes on. They've worked with so many great people. They're constantly working. I think they're too driven. They don't stop. But their story of how they came together and how they met and how they became...
It's a love story.
It really is a love story. And, you know, it's like this one English guy, he's like, you know, kind of subtle, and Miles, and then Al, who's like, yeah, so anyway. And I love these two guys. And they're probably going, you fuck. Well, I don't sound like that. But they just wrote a book, Double Exposure. Check it out. Let's get inside the creators of Smallville, Al Goff and Miles Miller. It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience. This is really exciting. Are you guys hot?
No, we're good.
You just tell me if you're hot.
Okay.
I'm pretty hot. Al, are you hot? Let's roll.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome to Smallville Week, folks. This is the interview with the creators of Smallville, the guys that made it all happen. Now, these guys have been friends. I've known them for quite some time. You know, this is exciting for me because we've talked about, Al, you listen to the podcast
all the
time.
I do. I've been a longtime listener from the beginning.
Yeah, and you just text me, and you're like, I love this, I love how open you... You know, because you're a busy guy, and it's just like...
I schlep children, so I'm in the car a lot.
Right.
But honestly, I think my favorite... The one where I was like, wow, Michael really has this down, was your Jimmy Connors interview.
Really?
I thought that was great.
And I love that, too. You know what's funny is...
You know why? Because you didn't know him.
I didn't know him, and I was scared.
And it was really good.
Could you sense that I was nervous?
I could not sense you were nervous, but I thought your questions were good, and... I've been a longtime Jimmy Connors fan from back in the day when it was him and McEnroe.
Yeah.
And
but you like McEnroe better.
I was much more of a McEnroe guy as a kid, but I thought your Jimmy Connors.
Because Al always seems like he's really like mild-mannered, but actually has this inner rage.
Oh, my God.
Does he have a rage? See, you guys all both.
He's always pushing this narrative.
Now, if you're wondering who I'm talking to, Al is
pushing this narrative.
Look, Miles speaks in an English accent. He has a nice British accent.
Is it
totally fake?
Is it really British?
No, he's from Britain. Right?
But it's a little mid-Atlantic now, I call it.
Is it?
So
it's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean mid-Atlantic? So
it's somewhere
between...
over the Bermuda Triangle. Right. Yeah.
That's where it is. It's just kind of lost in translation.
Yeah, a little bit.
I like it. Look, this show is called Inside of You. And, you know, most of the time I deal with actors, directors, producers, musicians, athletes. And really, you know, I interviewed David Nutter. David's fantastic. He, you know, the guy's been like, he's the guy who sold. How many pilots?
Oh,
he's
50.
He's the Steven Spielberg of television.
He really is. Yeah. And he did all the big episodes of Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
And
he did the Red Wedding. Yeah.
You guys watch Game of Thrones?
I do.
Al does.
Yeah.
You do. What do you watch, Miles?
I watch a lot of stuff. I don't watch Game of Thrones, though.
What's your favorite show on television?
Right now?
Yeah.
I love Homeland.
Homeland?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was that's been on for a long time.
It has. Like Americans.
Yeah.
Like Stranger Things.
You like Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see the show Dark on Netflix?
Love Dark.
It's fantastic.
That's one of my favorite series there is.
That's amazing.
So look, part of this show is we get to know where people come from. Not just like, hey, what are you doing today? Because I know you got a book out. I know you got Badlands season coming up. I know there's all this stuff going on in your lives. And you're like, we've had meetings. We've discussed projects. But, you know, this is Smallville week.
Yeah.
And it is inside of you. So
yes.
For those listening, I think it'd be really interesting to learn about how, you know, where you guys are from and how you guys kind of, you know, how you met. I know you met in school at USC, correct?
That is correct.
But what were you doing? Were you always, Al, were you growing up thinking I'm going to be a writer, creator? And was that always in your head or what were you thinking?
I grew up in a small town in Southern Maryland. And the movie bug bit me. I mean, like a lot of us in our generation, you know, with Star Wars and Raiders. But it was really E.T. And I remember going to see it opening night in this crappy theater in a place called Lexington Park, Maryland, which was a small community up against Patuxent River Naval Air Station. So it's a big military crowd. And I remember seeing E.T. opening night. And
how old were you?
I was 14.
14.
Yeah. And I was like, I want to do this. I don't know exactly what this is. The first credit that came up after the movie was over was directed by Steven Spielberg. I'd obviously heard of Spielberg because of, you know, Raiders and Jaws and Close Encounters and stuff, but I never really understood what a movie director did.
Right.
And so that's when the bug sort of bit me. But then it took me 10 years between that time till I went to film school. So
were you constantly bothering your folks and like, this is what I want to do?
Oh, yeah.
I want to be a director. I want to be a writer.
Something. I want to be in the movie business, which was the equivalent of saying, I want to go to the moon.
Right.
Like nobody in Southern Maryland knew anything about.
Were they
the
good parents?
Business.
Did you have good parents?
They were great.
They were. They always supported you. Were they those parents that were like, I love you, Al?
There's not a lot of that.
Did they call you Al?
I was Little Al because my dad is Big Al. I'm the third.
Little Al? Yes. We had a Big
Alfred
Al.
Alfred Goff the third.
I'm Alfred Goff the third. And by the way, Alfred Fabian Goff the third.
Fabian?
Yes.
You could have been a porn star.
Absolutely.
Fabian Goff.
Faby Baby would be my porn name.
Faby Baby.
That would have been my porn name.
Wow. So they were supportive.
They were great. And I grew up in a small town, and they were not... Now they're the opposite of helicopter parents. They're more like drone parents. Like you could just go out and do stuff and they would eventually find you.
Really? But, that's sort of what my parents were. Where are you going? Just go.
Yeah, just go. The thing is, they knew everybody. They didn't need social media. They had friends. They had a police scanner. So they knew what we were.
The handy police scanner.
They knew what we were doing.
Right.
You know, I think when we were younger, we thought we were so clever. And then we just realized, nah, they just let us get away with shit.
Were you a partier? Were you a drinker? Were you a smoker? Were you just a good kid?
I was a good kid. In high school, I did like to go to parties.
You did, so, but did you do drugs?
I'm sorry. I didn't believe that for a second.
I drank and...
I've never seen him drink ever.
No, I haven't. I sort of gave that up after college, but I used to, yeah.
So did you stop drinking because you just didn't like it?
I was just bored with it.
You just didn't like it? It didn't make you feel good?
No.
So you didn't like...
The idea of Al drunk is kind of impossible to imagine even.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
I would either get super loud... or super sleepy. So
that was it.
Yeah. And it was only beer. Like once I think in college I tried like hard liquor and like threw up and I was out.
Now Miles.
Yes.
What about you? You went to Catholic school, right?
No.
You didn't?
No.
Were you Catholic?
No, absolutely not.
I'm Catholic.
You're the Catholic
Al's
one?
Catholic. Everyone thinks Al's Jewish actually, but it's kind of weird.
Do.
Well,
they do. Well,
Goff seems Jewish.
Yeah.
What is Goff?
It is actually English.
Very English.
Yeah. English.
Yeah, but basically my family showed up in like 1634 in Maryland, looked around, said, this is nice, and stayed for 400 years.
That's amazing.
No wandering.
Not big explorers.
Not big explorers.
But Miles, what about you?
So I grew up in Australia, actually. So sort of the Australian.
Why did I know that? I didn't know you grew up in Australia.
Yeah, so my family's Australian.
That's where his rage comes from.
Yeah. So I grew up in Australia, and then when I was 9, moved to England and went to boarding school in England till I was 18. So I had this like very, actually wasn't a strict boarding school, but it was pretty.
Were English. Your parents pretty strict?
No, actually.
No.
I was wandering around London by myself when I was 11. So I had a great.
You never got spanked?
I never got spanked.
No.
I had a master at my school wash my mouth out with soap.
What did you say?
I said the word bugger.
Bugger. And what does bugger mean?
Bugger.
Is it like shit? Fuck?
It's sodomy, yeah. But it's like...
bugger. You know what that is, Rob?
Yeah, I've heard it.
So tell someone to bugger off, they basically...
Oh, fuck off.
Yeah, basically.
Bugger off.
Yeah.
Right.
So
there's
this really...
You didn't want to say the F-bomb. You didn't want to do it, Miles.
I don't know what I said that.
Are you not an F-bomber?
Oh
my God,
bomber.
Yes.
Well, you get
absolutely.
Mad. We'll get into your rage. We'll get into your Jimmy Connors rage.
I'm pretty rageful.
Yeah. You know, you liked your parents. I mean, they were good. So
great,
you both
amazing.
Had good parents growing up. There was no any infidelity in the house. There was no drug using. There was no...
My favorite story, Miles' parents are great, and his dad was hysterical. And I remember at his wedding, in the small chapel, I can't remember where exactly, what little town we were in.
Right.
Yeah. And so Miles was signing... his marriage license, and I'm the best man. I'm sitting next to his father. He literally leans over me and goes, didn't learn to write his name until he was 8 years old. That's all he said.
That's it? With an, yeah. with an accent, Australian
yeah.
accent?
It was hysteric, yes.
Did your dad speak with an Australian accent?
He did, yeah.
He passed?
He did.
When did he pass?
I guess, actually, 8 years ago.
Wow, has it been 8 years?
Yeah.
Was that one of the toughest things you had to go through?
It's very tough.
Were you very close?
Very close. It was it's a passage of life, but yeah, it's very surprising and shocking when it happens to you. And it's only when it happens to you do you understand it.
And how old was he?
He was 80.
80?
Yeah, and it happened very quickly. I was speaking to him one day, and next he was gone.
And for any reason, or just, was it cancer? Was it an aneurysm?
It was pneumonia. So he should have looked after himself better. But literally, I was speaking to him one day, and then the next, and I have the two kids. They got to speak to him, and the next day I got a call in the middle of the night that he'd gone.
You weren't expecting him to pass?
No. And also, it's a distance. I was in Los Angeles, and he's in London, so it's
how do you deal with that? How do you? Are you a guy that you seem like, just knowing you, I've known you 20 years, I guess.
That's right.
But I've known you as my boss. I've known you as, but we've become friends, right. Of course. But I don't know on you on a personal level like Al or, we don't go out for beers together or go out and, you know, hang out. But like, I notice like you're very, how would I say this? You keep everything sort of inside until it blows up.
That's right.
And all these things, it's like, you build these things, little things build. How did you cope with it? Was there anger? Was there, are you a crier? Do you get emotional?
I get emotional very much. Yeah.
Cause I do too.
Yeah.
And Rob doesn't.
Rob, I can see that with you. I can see that you would be kind of cold.
Rob's very even keeled, I think is how I describe it.
You know, I'm really more Israeli like that. I get super emotional and super angry and rageful. And Al's the steady course, right? He's the steady boat.
I'm more British than Miles.
Yeah, is the thing. But I think when people get to know me, they're surprised. I think I have a sort of intimidating presence, maybe.
I think at first, because I think just an English accent, yeah. you're immediately yes. intimidated.
Yeah.
If someone's going, excuse me, Michael, will you come here for a second? I'm like, oh my God, what did I do?
Yeah.
It's just something different. English people sound smarter. Immediately,
which
they're smarter.
Which is complete shit, because they're not. Yeah.
Is that true?
Absolutely.
But they sound smart no matter what they say. It's yeah. So, Al, do you remember that moment? Did you call Al, or did you
texted me.
Did I?
And I couldn't believe it.
And you just said my dad passed.
Yeah, you said my, and I was like, what
did you? So, what? How did you react?
I think I called him, and then we talked, and then you had to get on the plane like the next day.
How did you do that? You had to go for work. You had to fly out for work. You had to fly out for a funeral.
Yeah,
yeah.
Now, did you speak? Of course, you had to.
I didn't speak.
You didn't?
No, I didn't know it.
I figured you would have gotten up and said something instead.
No, I wrote something. I couldn't speak.
You couldn't speak.
No.
You just could not. You were like,
which I still feel like I'm a coward, but I couldn't do it.
No, so. Did your wife say, do you want to do this? You're like, I can't do this.
Exactly. So.
Well, I don't blame you. I think about this all the time. It's like my grandfather's my best friend, and
right.
he's got Alzheimer's, and I know he's going to die, and I don't know. It's not much time.
Right.
And he's been like a father figure to me. And I'm like, when that day comes, and I think about it every so often, like, I'm going to have to speak. I'm his best friend. They all know that I was the first grandson. I have to speak. I can't speak. I can't do that. I couldn't go up there.
Well, you're completely unprepared for what happens. So grief is an amazing thing to actually experience, because it's not like it's completely unexpected.
Yeah.
So right. when you get to experience it, which everyone does, it's shocking.
Is there someone that when you went to the funeral that you see that immediately, like when from my grandmother died, I saw my brother, and he's very, you know, not standoff, but he doesn't emote. He doesn't, you know, he keeps everything inside. And we locked eyes and just went to each other and embraced and cried. So is there someone that when you saw them, you fell apart?
No, I think what's interesting is when you meet other people who've lost parents, you feel an immediate bond. So you have that connection.
Right.
So there's a friend of ours from film school who lost, I remember writing a note to her and her mother suddenly died. And it was like, we really felt a bond.
And that helps.
Yeah. Well, it's an understanding of how life goes. Another chapter of your life is finished, but also another moment of understanding how life, the cycle of life. It sounds like a cliche or Disneyfied, but actually it's just an important moment in your life. You realize when people talk about grief, what it is. Yeah. And I'd never experienced, I had a completely blessed life. You know, nothing ever bad had happened to my family. No cancer, no drugs, no drink, no alcoholics. It's just like, it was just very, shocking to experience that, but everyone does.
So and how long did it take to be feel like a human again, to feel creative again, to feel like you could move on? Did you use work as a tool to sort of help you get through it? Like, I need to keep working to...
Well, we never stop working. That's what keeps us going, right?
Yeah.
So that's our drug is work. That is our addiction.
If you stop, you think you'd go crazy?
Yeah. We don't. It's impossible for me to imagine stopping.
Al's nodding his head. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It literally is our drug.
Because I've said this to you many times, especially you, Al.
Yeah.
I've said, you've made millions. Smallville and Into the Badlands and Shanghai Night and like on and on. The Hannah Montana movie, the Eddie Murphy. Well, not the Eddie Murphy movie. But all these things you've done with your life. And it's like, you could retire easily. You could, but you love work.
Yeah.
You love the whole process.
Retire and do what? I'm doing the thing we love to do.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Just spend every day with Beth?
I could do that.
All day?
By the way, she would get really tired of that.
She'd get tired of you, get tired of her. Wait till you're 80 or something. But Miles, so the one thing that I take from this that's good is that your dad was 80 and he saw a lot of your success. He saw you peaking, really, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that's a terrific feeling to know that your dad saw this.
Yeah, you get that parental pride, which is sort of unbeatable, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that was great.
Yeah, it's tragic. It scares me to think that one day, you know, it's so logical and so like right in your face, like, hey, today you have someone, tomorrow you don't. People are like, hey, how many times a day do we hear, this person's here now, love them with all you got.
Yeah.
He may not be here. And you take it for granted because you can't think about that shit all the time.
No. But it was a couple years ago. My parents had their 50th wedding anniversary, so I threw them a big party. Right. I said, invite all your friends, because frankly, the only time I ever go back to Southern Maryland was for funerals. You know what I mean? Like close friends that might, I mean, my father.
You go back to the crab bowl sometimes.
Yeah. But
the what?
It's the crab bowls.
The crab balls.
Yeah. That's the specialty of Southern Maryland,
yes.
Crab balls.
Crab balls and stuffed ham.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I had crab balls in college.
You may have.
Or just the prefix of that.
But no, I said, look, I'm tired of you're only seeing people at funerals. So we had like a big party, and the funny line was, you know, you see somebody you haven't seen in years, and he's like, it's great to see you, and they're like, it's good to be seen.
It's good to be seen.
Good to be seen.
So let me tell you. So I'm sorry for getting so intimate with you, Miles, but this is what I love. I don't love that your father passed. I love that you're vulnerable and you're talking about real things, and that's what. Let's fast forward. You had a good good parents. You were raised well. You guys met at USC.
Yes.
That's kind of where it all took off. Now, explain that. What were you doing at USC where you met and you kind of had some kind of bond?
We were in the Peter Stark Motion Picture Producing Program, which is part of the graduate film program at USC.
And what do you need to get into USC?
Well, it's interesting. So after college, I moved to New York and I was working in PR. And I did it for 3 years. And I was about, you know, I was about to turn 25. And I said, if I don't do something now, it's never going to happen. You know what I mean? You're going to just become one of these people that put on a suit and go to an office. And so I was looking at film programs. And I only wanted to be in Hollywood, only in LA. So I looked at UCLA and USC. And the USC programs, it was obviously the writing program, the production program, you know, cinema theory. And then they had the Peter Stark producing program. And when I looked at that, I was like, ooh, this is actually everything I want to do, because it gives you a bit of a buffet platter of show business. So there was no film required. It was like an essay, I think some letters of recommendation, an application, and like GRE scores.
And lots of money.
And lots of money, but sure. But that was, for me, it was a lot of student loans.
Right.
So I was just like, I don't care.
So you paid for your college.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And how much is it to go to college at USC for all the years you went?
I think I...
Quarter of a million?
No, it wasn't that bad, but I think when I walked out of film school between undergrad loans and film school, I was at $125,000.
Jeez.
Yeah. But yeah, so we went to this program and they take 20 people a year.
Yeah.
And it is the most type A, it could have been a reality show. So
we had a very exceptional class though.
Yeah.
Like really amazing.
Who was in that class that I would know?
It was John Glickman, who's the president of production of MGM. John August, who's a big screenwriter, Jim Whitaker, who's a producer. There's a lot of people who are still in show business.
Lots of agents, writers.
Yeah, yeah. Greg producers. McKnight.
20. So out of the 20, these guys were part of the 20.
Yeah. Probably at least 14 are still significant.
Were there any ones that left and became nothing?
Well, there was one guy who became a fireman, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right.
out in Simi Valley.
What's his name?
His name's Chad.
His name's Chad.
He's Chad. Chad in Simi Valley. Yeah.
And does Chad ever call you and go, hey, guys?
No, Chad's sad he doesn't.
You know how show business work. Once you're out of the orbit, it's like you're out.
Like Jake Ryan from 16 Candles. He's out.
He's out.
Yeah.
Inside of You is brought to you by Rocket Money. I love Rocket Money. You know why? Because everyone should have Rocket Money because it just helps you save money. How many times do we have subscriptions that we don't even know we have anymore and we're paying so much money? It's just throwing away money, Ryan.
I found one.
You did it. You told me. I got Rocket Money.
Okay, I found one. I'm embarrassed to say how long it's been going on, but thank you for finding it. My God. It was embarrassing.
Yeah, because it's like you want to watch some show and you go, I have to subscribe to this this streaming whatever. Mm-hmm. And you start streaming the show, you watch it, you leave, and you forget after this trial period it kicks in and they're charging you $10 a month. It is embarrassing.
Ugh.
You know, 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about. Before I started using Rocket Money, I thought I had, you know, like, oh, I have like 5 subscriptions. I could not believe it when they showed me I was paying for like 4 extra between, you know, streaming devices and fitness apps, delivery services. It's never ending. And thanks to Rocket Money, I'm no longer wasting money on the ones I forgot about. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features.
Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lowering your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. And I like that.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/inside. That's rocketmoney.com/inside. rocketmoney.com/inside.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Macy's, Adidas, Walmart, Nike, Wine.com, Samsung, Lenovo, Sephora, and more. And even stack sales on top of cashback. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Okay, so you guys are both in this class.
Yeah.
And do you remember the moment you met?
Yes. This is at the George Lucas building, which has now been demolished by George Lucas because he built a much bigger building. But there was a little really like almost like Planet of the Apes courtyard, concrete bunker. And they had this little cocktail party for the new students. Remember this?
Mm-hmm.
And that we met at this cocktail party. And Al, we sort of hit it off. We started talking about movies. We had this similar taste. And I gave Al my number to say, let's see a movie this weekend. And I'm the worst with numbers. So I wrote down the wrong number.
Yeah.
And he tried to call me and it didn't work. It was the wrong number. Yeah.
Pig.
It's like he was blowing me off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I'm known
sure,
to do.
Here's your number.
This is what girls usually do to us.
It's true.
So that bros.
Exactly.
So that didn't work. But eventually we met up in class again and then began to.
Yeah.
We teamed up in a class and did a screenplay together and stuff like that.
Were you like, oh, I'm so sorry. That's a 9, not a 6.
I never had a phone number before, by the way.
Yeah.
So it was all new to me in America. I never had a car.
And Miles learned how to drive in LA.
Yeah.
If you can imagine that.
Oh my God.
And he had this little like old manual.
It was a white VW Rabbit.
VW Rabbit with a Bob Marley sticker in the back, which is how you can always recognize it. And
I bought it for $700.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And I remember the day you finally got rid of it. It was at that place on Cahuenga, just below the 101.
Yeah, just sold my first script.
Yeah. And then was that Mango?
That was Mango.
I had a crash. Someone rear-ended me.
Did your rage come out?
No, I was like...
No, I think it was like time to get rid of that car.
Yeah.
No, wait a minute. You just fast forward. So you sold a script. Now, you're still in school?
We're still in school.
Now, what are the odds of selling a script when you're still at film school?
It's like the lottery. But I will say Hollywood was a different place back then. And there were scripts that were selling, you know, three a day for, you know, upwards to $1 million. I mean, this was really the spec script bonanza of the late 80s and early 90s. That really went on to like 95.
Right.
I think is really what it was.
And yeah, that's very good of a date.
No, because
spec scripts don't sell now.
No.
It's impossible.
It's almost impossible. And that's because now it's all about IP or something existing.
It's all about marketing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, this is in the day of, you know, Shane Black and Joe Esterhaus and, you know, people selling huge scripts. So there was a gold rush mentality to it. But just because you sell a script doesn't mean you're going to have a career. It is like winning the lottery. Right. So for us, it was our tuition to learn how to write. And so we would write 7 days a week, 9 to 7.
Do you remember the first day you started writing together? Like, we're going to write a project together. Did it just come easy to you guys working together?
Working together came easy because we were friends. And I think a lot of the heavy lifting is done when you're breaking the story and you're figuring out and you're outlining it and things like that. And that's where it really helps to have two people.
Who's the dialogue guy, if you have to say?
Al.
And you're the structure guy?
We're both structure guys.
Yeah.
But it's definitely...
But I think it's all... I mean, honestly, we've been writing together 25 years.
Sort of symbiotic.
Years.
It's sort of, you know...
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're in college and you're like, hey, let's write this script together. And tell me if I'm wrong, but didn't an orangutan was part of this?
That's right.
Yes.
So the first script was called Mango, and it was a buddy comedy about a cop and an orangutan. And the orangutan was called Mango. And the idea was that the cop was the animal, the slob, and the orangutan was the gentleman, sort of like.
Yeah.
So they're sort of reverse. But we sold it the week after
Ace Ventura
came out. So it was all timing as well.
Perfect timing. Yeah.
So it was really more to do with time. Well, again, everything's to do with timing and luck.
Whose idea was it to go out with it? And where did you go? And who's going to take your meeting? I guess you're at USC.
We had a lot of friends who were assistants.
We used the USC Mafia.
Yeah, we used the USC Mafia. But what was interesting was it was ending up on people's desks and people weren't reading it. And then my wife, at the time my girlfriend, Beth, she worked at ICM in business affairs. She was an assistant there. And there was a guy named Warren Zeide who just left to...
Then he sings, ooh, werewolves in London.
That's Warren Zevon.
Oh, Warren Zevon.
Close.
Yes, Warren Zevon sold our first spec. It's a fantastic story. And he was starting up and he was becoming a manager, which again, was not something people had back in the early 90s. And he read it and liked it. And we said, you can be our manager, but you have to get us an agent. And he got it to an agent named David Warden, who had a small boutique agency called Warden, White & Kane. And he represented Jeff Arch, who wrote Sleepless in Seattle, and Sam Hamm, who wrote Batman. And it went out and there was a...
Sold out in
bidding war?
48 hours.
Yeah.
Sold for $400,000.
Yes.
That pays off your student loans.
Yeah, a lot of it, yeah.
Now, how much is $400,000 then, now? Was that $1 million script?
If they had made it, it would have been.
It would have been.
Yeah.
So there's all these
It's always this against this and stuff like that. But here's the thing is...
It opened the door.
It opened the door.
Absolutely.
But you have to make it last because you don't know when the next one's coming.
Because if you have another script after that and it's a piece of shit, you're like, oh, whatever.
Well, we did have another script, which didn't sell.
Yeah. So we ended up writing, I think, 5 specs. We sold Mango, and then we sold another script called Favorite Son, which was a man on the run political thriller. We got a friend of ours had gotten some advice from his agent. He goes, you want to write something that sells? Write a young man on the run script. And he was like, I'm not doing that. And we're like, we are. That's a good idea. So it was called Favorite Son, and it was like a JFK Jr. type character who was on the run. Because we're like, what if a famous person was on the run? How does celebrity work for and against you?
That's cool.
Yeah, it was cool. And we sold it.
Still cool.
Yeah. No, it was really good. We sold that to Laura Ziskin and Leonard Goldberg, who's a, you know, famous television producer and movie producer. I mean, this guy's had a million lives.
Charlie's Angels and The Love Boat.
And he was.
That was his?
Yeah, Charlie's Angels.
Wow. Fantasy Island.
Love Boat.
And you guys
actually
ended up doing Charlie's
actually
Angels.
Love Boat wasn't him.
What was his Aaron?
Aaron had wanted him to go. I mean, Leonard told us a story. He had done, you know, Heart to Heart, Charlie's Angels, Starsky and Hutch, Fantasy Island. But he wanted to be a movie producer, so he was going to leave. And Aaron had heard the pitch for Love Boat and said, Leonard, please do this. Leonard went to his wife, Wendy, and Wendy's like, Aaron has this project and he wants me to do it. He goes, Leonard, you want to be out of that. You want to be a movie producer. You got to make a clean break. And so he goes, Leonard didn't do it. Aaron asked him three times. And then after the premiere, Leonard goes, I turn to Wendy and I go, congratulations, you owe me $65 million. So, because it just was a huge, huge hit. So anyway, so we sold the script to them. And I think for us, that was really the script where we became writers, you know what right. I mean? Because people really liked the writing in the script and the story was strong, and working with Leonard and with Laura Ziskin.
You guys grew up pretty fast. It sounds like, you know, I mean, from the time you sold your first script, people usually go through like a lot of struggles. You guys hit the lottery, like you said, but you were off and running.
Well, I think for us, we took it really seriously. We worked our asses off.
Yep.
We worked every single, I mean, this is the thing, we worked every single day.
Yeah.
For the next 15 years, literally every
single
day.
I mean, that's what it takes, doesn't it? You can't like everyone intermittently write.
No, you have to do, I mean, it is a muscle and you really have to do it.
Do you still do that? Do you still write every day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You guys write every day.
We're working on a spec now. We always have something we're writing because it's just, it keeps you,
so that's the key. If you're out there and you're a writer, I think it translates to any profession, right? I mean, if you're an actor and you don't work for a couple years, you kind of got to keep the muscle going.
Yeah. Well, here's a great thing about writing. As you know, you don't need permission to do it. You can just do it.
Or anything else. You just need a computer now. And you can be at Starbucks. You can be anywhere in the world. Yeah. Yes. Just do it.
So there's no startup costs. And also you can write your way. If you're in a career slump, you can write your way out of it.
Right.
You can change genres. You can do something different. And
there's never an excuse not to write.
Yeah.
How old were you when you graduated?
Film school?
Yeah.
26.
26.
Yeah.
And it was probably, what, about 5 years before Smallville happened?
Smallville, we graduated in 94, and Smallville
was 2001.
Well, 2000 for us.
2000 was when the pitch was?
Yeah. Yeah. So we had...
Because Smallville obviously was your biggest, greatest hit absolutely. At the time, right?
Yes. And so what's interesting is we were writing specs. We
were in movies.
Writing movie specs. Yeah. And we ended up moving to William Morris in, I think, 96. And one of the projects we had done was this BBC show called Bugs. Basically, it was an action-adventure Avengers, not the Marvel Avengers, but the old British Avengers type series. So it was secret agents.
Right.
And what they liked about us was that one was British and one was American, because they couldn't find British writers to write action-adventure. So we ended up writing two episodes, one for like their season two, one for season three, where we'd literally write the scripts. They would come to LA, we'd pitch them the story, work with the producers, we'd write the scripts and fax the scripts to them.
Fax the scripts.
Yes,
It would take hours.
Can you guys do that again? There was some kind of glitch here and there.
Oh, we had that sometimes where you're literally like, you go to lunch and you come back and like, oh, fuck it.
Why don't you just email it? I know. You couldn't email it at that point. Come on.
It's crazy. And so when we went to William Morris, we had a TV agent and we hadn't really thought about television. We came to film school.
It was very much church and state.
It was church and state.
You couldn't do both.
Yeah.
It was always like, you can't do both, guys. You got to choose. Right. It's like,
okay. Things change.
And then what happened was, and we frankly weren't getting much traction on the movie side. We sold a few things, but nothing had been made.
I mean, that's the truth. You can sell a script, but your career only really changes, like hits the next level when you get a movie made.
Yeah.
I've sold four scripts and they never got made. It's impossible. People think there's so many levels. It's like getting a meeting.
Yeah,
with the right people, getting it bought. Then we do all these, it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and I'm not sure it's still the same, but, you know, back in the day, people could have really lucrative careers and never have anything produced, which was always, must be so weird.
Right.
So we started doing television. They said, okay, you should write basically spec episodes. And this was back in the day when you would write an episode of a show that you liked and use that as
an example.
I will
say that we also did we kept our education going. Did a UCLA extension class in sitcom writing, which was great.
They still have that class?
I'm not sure. Well, the guy who taught us isn't doing it. He's now like a marriage therapist, but he was, he'd been a big writer in the 70s.
I think he was divorced three times, by the way.
Yeah.
Right.
but it was a great class and we learned a lot, and it's sort of how to infuse humor into our writing.
Yeah.
Right.
So it was something that, and drama, great drama has great comedy as well. So it was a sort of a revelation for us. And then from that, we went on into sort of broke into television. But yeah. We initially had a spec sitcom, Third Rock from the Sun, which is a great sitcom. And we had a Homicide, Life on the Streets spec.
Remember that show?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we went into NBC and they were literally like, what do you want to do, sitcom or drama? Like, we didn't even realize that the church and state within television between being a sitcom writer and a drama writer. And we chose drama because it was frankly closer to movies.
And I'd suck in a writer's room like that. This I would be great with joking around, but I'd be like, oh my God, I couldn't keep
Are
up.
You not good in a pitch room?
No, Al pitches.
I pitch, but what's interesting
But they've got to hear the English accent every once in a while.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's important. It's like, oh, this guy's English. Yeah. He's smart.
Yeah.
I can be like silent and enigmatic.
Silent and enigmatic.
You just say
like,
one thing. Like,
you're like, he's like, he's classy. Let's wind that guy up and have him do the pitch. There you go.
Yeah, I think it's Al. And then all of a sudden you go, and this is what we have. You just throw a few sentences out and they're like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah. I like, yeah. Oh, yeah. Look at that guy. He talks. Yeah.
Okay, great.
So how did Smallville come about?
We had staffed on a few television shows that didn't.
Thankfully. Really, really bad shows.
Yeah, not good. This is a
what
time.
What shows were they?
They were Time Cop.
You could say Time Cop.
And that was
eight episodes.
That was 97.
Great people on the show. Great but people. The show, literally, when you sign on for a TV show, it was three years.
Back in the day.
So it was like, holy crap. If we were stuck on Time Cop for 3 years, I don't know what I'd do.
Yeah.
But it only went eight episodes.
That went eight. And then actually from that, we had a really good, we ended up writing two of the eight episodes and we were story editors, which is very low on the totem pole. Like when you see all those production credits on the television show.
You're not getting rich.
No.
But at that point, you get paid for the scripts you write, which is for us is huge.
You get paid for the scripts and they pay you a salary.
We bought new cars.
So I felt like Tom Hanks in Big. You remember when he was working for the company, he got his first check.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh my God. And the guy's like, John Lovitz is like, don't get too excited. That was us.
right.
So we staffed on those shows, always with the eye towards creating our own show and being able to run it.
So another show.
Yeah, we got
Marshall Law with Colton Hughes, became a big dude with Lost and Jack Ryan. So he was sort of a mentor to us.
Yeah. And so we did that show with Carl, which was martial arts, where we are sort of, that was also in our sort of Hong Kong.
That's how you got around to Badlands eventually. Yeah. That was the little beginnings.
Exactly. And we sort of were having a two-track career between, at that point, between movies and television. Because the usual thing, once one starts, the other one kicked in. So television, we'd staffed on Time Cop and Martial Law, both of which didn't, I think Martial Law went a season. But in the meantime, we'd gotten with Joel Silver, who on the movie side, we'd written two movies for him and Dick Donner, two Cinemax movies. One was like a hitman movie called Double Tap, which is, it's terrible, but it stars Stephen Ray and Heather Locklear.
Wow. It's
that good. And then the second Sounds one, good. Which actually turned out kind of better, was called Made Men with Jim Belushi and Michael Beach. And that was like a bag of money. You know, it's like, bad guy's a bag of money. He's hiding out in the town. You know, his old crew comes to get him. So they were those. But we had a great relationship working with Joel and Dick and their team. And one of his
Dick Donner, who Dick directed Donner. The Lethal Weapon. Oh,
And Superman. And we asked him many Superman questions before we were doing Smallville. But they said, we're hearing pitches for Lethal Weapon 4. Why don't you come in and pitch? And they said, Dick has a few things he wants to do. So if you can take his ideas, but he has no plot, and come up with a plot. And so we spent a weekend, and we were still on Time Cop at that
point. Just the weekend.
Because they were like, they want to hear it on Monday, and they told us on Friday.
Well, no, it was like, these are time counts.
Time count.
So the sooner you get in here, the better.
Because here's the thing. And this is
on a Friday.
This is on a Friday, because they were literally like, we have Mel and Danny and Renee and Joe.
Is it Renee Russo?
Russo.
Right.
January of 1998, like that's when their window, and the movie's coming out in July of 98. So it was like shooting a TV pilot.
So we need a pitch now.
We need a script.
And you're working on the weekend.
Yes. So we came up with a pitch. We go in on a Monday. We leave our office at Universal where we're doing Time Cop, go through the back gate over to Warner Brothers, pitch it to Dick Donner on the phone. He signs off. Then we have to wait for Joel for 3 hours. And he comes back in.
It's Joel Silver, the producer.
And he's a big collector. So he was walking around this table looking at these like Art Deco toys. And he literally comes in and goes, okay, great, go. And then we start pitching and we're following him around the table. And about three quarters, he sits down, listens to the rest of the pitch. This pitch was like 10 minutes long. It was not long. And he goes, I like it. He goes, that's great. He goes, here's what I want you to do. I want you to call the studio and tell them to hear the pitch. And then he looks at guys, take out all the action sequences. Just go exciting action sequence here because Dick doesn't want to commit to any sequences right now. And if the studio has a question, you just tell them Joel and Dick love it and start writing. That's what he did. So he goes,
so you were in.
We were in. So we were, and of course, we grew up on Lethal Weapon movies like that.
So you were like, I can't believe
we can't believe we're writing a Lethal Weapon movie.
You guys don't look like two guys that really just jump up and just fucking get hammered and
Get hammered. No, that was like a stress. No. Like holy crap. What
so
gonna
when you relieve when they say you got it, you're writing the new Lethal Weapon 4. What do you? How do you party?
You're like, oh well, you don't, because we had to go back to work on the show
on Time Cop.
On Time Cop, and then so we're like going, and they're like, where have you been for the last couple hours?
Were you like, fuck you, Time Cops?
No.
We're going to work on Lethal Weapon. You didn't tell him?
No.
Why?
Because then we had the guy who was running that show was so paranoid and felt like the 88 writer's strike had ruined his movie career. Oh. So he was super bitter. And there was no writer's room on that show, but we'd be in our office. And every now and then he'd just open the door and be like, what are you guys doing? So, and the best part was we had gone in, this was probably a couple of weeks in, Joel and Dick's assistants call and say, hey, why don't you come in and pitch Joel and Dick where you are? We're probably a week away from finishing the script. So we're like, if this goes terribly, we're screwed.
Fine, yeah.
So we go over, we pitch them what we're doing. They love it. They say, great, keep writing. Get us the script as soon as possible. It was 2 days later. We're sitting in our office. Joel Silver calls and he goes, hey guys, it's Joel. Dick and I are sitting here with Mel Gibson. And we started pitching him the script and we thought, fuck it, you guys should pitch it. So hold on, I'm going to put you on speakerphone. Right there in the office.
And we had this paranoid guy who's literally going to break into our office at any second. We got Mel Gibson and Al's pitching away the story. It was like the most, literally, we'd have been in such trouble.
Oh my God, yes.
Are you freaking out? You're sweating, you're red faced.
Yeah, because you're just
I can't, sometimes you can't be articulate when you're nervous and you're put on the spot. Sometimes when people, what's the show about? You're like...
Well, here's the good news is we'd written so much of the script, we knew
what
it was.
You knew it inside out.
Yeah, so we could pitch jokes and things like that, which was great.
And it went well.
Yeah.
Was Mel like, all right, guys, it's really great, really great.
Yeah, he really liked it. So the movie started. So we're writing Lethal Weapon 4. And at the time we were doing it, our friend John Glickman was running a company called Spyglass. And he was making a movie with Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker called Rush Hour. So he kept calling, going, what's the plot of Lethal Weapon 4? Because both of them had an Asian element to it. Both of them were set in L.A.
Shanghai.
They were cop shows.
This is where Shanghai
so he goes, look, he goes, we're making this movie with Jackie. If it makes more than $40 million, we're going to make another movie with Jackie. And Jackie has an idea, and I want you guys to write it. We're like, great, what's the idea? And he goes, he wants to do a Western. We're like, great, what's the idea? He goes, that's the idea. So come up with a Western for Jackie.
So we come up with a Western, then we go over to pitch Jackie Chan and his manager, Willie Chan.
And who recently passed away.
So there's the four of us in this tiny office pitching this movie and...
Smoking cigars.
Everyone's smoking cigars. The four people in the room are smoking cigars. And
we're in a room this size.
Trying to pitch this story and Al's contact lenses pop out because it's so dry.
Super dry.
Because you're nervous.
And he's like, there's Jackie Chan, Al's on the floor, like crawling around looking for his contact lenses, trying to pitch this story. It was like,
yeah.
Are you serious? Like embarrassed?
Yeah, I was just like, just wait a minute.
Sweating.
And they're talking. And then the best with Jackie was, you know, when we were pitching, he goes, oh, I have an idea for a sequence. And he goes, stand up. So you stand up and then he starts using you as almost like a practice dummy for what he's going to do in the movie.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, it was great.
But you sell it.
We sell it. Done. You know, we sell it.
And that became franchise.
And that, yes, exactly. So that was
Shanghai Nights. Shanghai Noon. Shanghai Nights.
Exactly. So that's what's going on the movie side. So on the TV side, we'd done
that. I remember that was happening. That's when I met you.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Shanghai Nights was shooting the first season of Smallville. Remember, because I had to go to Prague and you were in Vancouver. So anyway, so we'd done these two shows. We'd gotten a deal with Joel at Warner Brothers to do a buddy cop television show. So
this is our first show we created called The Strip.
Right. That's with, I remember the bald guy from Powder.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, yes.
What's his name?
Sean Patrick Flannery.
Yeah. He was the young Indiana Jones.
And he was young Indiana Jones.
Thing with him, and he was a great guy, but he didn't want to be an actor at that point. He wanted to be a racing car driver. So he was like all about, can I get out on the weekends and Fridays? I want to work because I want to go race cars. It's like, well.
Sounds like me. Just want to get out
of
the time.
You're the star of the show.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that went like eight episodes.
It went
right?
eight episodes, but what was great about it was it was on UPN. It was kind of a low-key show, and Warner's let us run it. We had a good experience, and they made an overall deal with us, and they wanted us to do more shows. And so that's when it was the summer of 2000.
Peter Roth, who's the president of Warner Brothers.
Still is.
Warner Brothers.
Yes, he's been there for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Got the rights for Superman on television. And so he called us up. It was Andrew Plotkin, I remember. He called us up and said, we have the idea. We want to do Superman for TV. Peter's always loved Superboy. we want to do Superman in high school. Can you guys come up with a pitch? And so that's really how it started.
Yeah. Do you remember sitting thinking of ideas for Smallville?
Yeah.
And what this is about? Do you remember the first thing that made you kind of go, ooh, did one of you say something or that just kind of goes, oh, that's cool. Was there something that just spawned that? Because the idea of the story before the story when they're growing up, before Lex becomes evil, before Clark becomes Superman, but it's like this in this little town, everything happens before. It's such a great idea and a great world. That how did it kind of get going? How did that really start spinning?
Well, what's interesting is, you know, this is in 2000. A lot of people didn't think it was a great idea.
No,
we had a lot of friends who were like, that sounds super cheesy. Like,
well, I thought when they first approached me, I was like, I didn't really care.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was going to probably be cheesy.
Yeah.
Because again, it was WB.
Well, also the last.
But we always believed in it, actually. Yeah. We always thought it would be a hit. And that, I guess the first idea we really locked in on is the three. Is that there's this love triangle at its core, which is the Lana, Lex, and Clark. With that, and the idea of making the Kents much younger.
Yeah.
And of course, taking away the costume as well and really grounding Superman. The idea, I always had a problem with that character, is I never understood why he was so good.
Yeah.
Why does he just innately decide to be good? So getting to that root of that question. And then the idea that emerged was the
meteor shower.
The meteor shower, which changed, which gave it a franchise, which gave it an engine week to week.
Who was he going to fight in? We needed the
it couldn't just be Boy Detective. It couldn't just be him running around the town like solving crime. It just seemed
right. But the meteor shower not only brings him to Earth, but it also changes Lex's life forever.
Yes.
Oh, completely.
That was the idea that it actually changes all three of their lives, Lex, Lana, and Clark on the same day.
Because her parents die.
Parents also die.
Lex in particular, because there was no connection between Lex's childhood and Clark in that way. And the idea is he lost his hair, which sort of like really wounds Lex in a very deep way psychologically the rest of his life. And particularly the new relationship that we establish with Lionel Luthor when that look that John Glover gives when he sees the little kid in the corn without the hair is like the tufts of hair.
So it's kind of disgusted in a way.
Yeah.
Complete disgust that his ideal of his son has been destroyed in that moment. Right. So the idea that this guilt that Clark carries and is a reason why he becomes who he becomes was something that really excited us as writers.
Yeah.
And was also the challenge was how do you bring something new to this legend? What's ironic now is that in this day and age where people are so religious about canon, about what's happened before, we would never be allowed to do what we did.
Yeah.
We would never be allowed. And just really the constraints I feel on superhero movies, which have to be so loyal to their source, is really a detriment to storytelling. That we were very fortunate that no one was looking at us. That we had free range to do whatever we wanted.
And DC and Warner Brothers and the WB were all super supportive, you know.
Do you remember when you pitched it to Peter Roth?
Yeah.
Was he ecstatic?
Yeah.
He's like, really this is slam dunk sold.
But we actually would go, it was almost like over the course of a month, like every Friday, I felt like every Friday afternoon we would go in and sit down and pitch out more of it.
And it was also like, it was very collaborative. And we're very collaborative as people in terms of we love to have.
If you like an idea, you'll use it. You don't sit there and go, no, it's not our idea,
exactly.
So it sucks.
Exactly.
There's a lot of writers that do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And for us, because eventually we get credit anyway, so it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, who gives a shit? Someone comes up with the idea, I got credit.
We want the best. And we love, actually, it's like the puzzle of screenwriting, the puzzle of story is how do you figure out those problems and solve them in a creative way. So that's something we really enjoy. And I think one of the reasons we're still working is because we have that ability to be collaborative and not be defensive.
You're malleable.
Well, not malleable. It's just like we're open.
Yeah.
We're not going to be like... If it's a good idea, it's a good idea.
I guess you are stern in the things that you want. You're like, I'm not changing our ways for that. Have you always been like that? If you really believe in something, you're not going to change for someone.
No, we've got a really strong point of view about what we do
right.
and how it should be. And I think we're very clear about that as well. So you have to be on that bus. But within the boundaries we set, you have complete free range.
Right.
If you speak to people who work with us, from production designers or cinematographers or directors, it's like once they know what we want, we leave him alone.
Yeah. And I noticed like just on set, like, you know, you talk about how Al is really good with the dialogue and you're both really good with structure and you work so well together. But it seems to me, I remember you seemed like you were a stronger voice maybe if you weren't happy with something on set or if something of the costumes or things that you didn't like, you were the one that were like, you wanted this way. This, why isn't it like this? Why does she look like that? You were the one that said it. You were very passionate.
Yeah, I'm very much, I'm the one on set. Al's more in the writer's room and dealing with executives.
And the budget.
And the budget. So in terms of how we...
that sucks, Al.
...differentiate our lives, I'm very much about the look of the show, the costumes, the production design, working with the crew. I love all that. I love the actual physical element of it. I love working with like the practical effects teams and all those sort of things. But then also being really clear in terms of the definitions of what a character should wear, hair and makeup, all those things are sort of like my domain, and Al's much more about the...
Miles is an outdoor cat and I'm an indoor cat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's jump ahead to, they like the script. It's in good shape. How long quickly does it take to get the script to where they want it?
The first thing though, is that the WB, who felt like the natural home for this show, the year before had told us, an executive, that we weren't WB writers. That we were too male, like too action.
Like you do male action.
Who is this guy?
It was a woman. It is still a good friend of ours, and I love the teaser about it. And
you write too
well.
Much like men.
Yeah.
Well, it was like you're not really WB
testosterone.
And there was this book. The WB had a book of writers that were approved on the approved book. We were not on the approved list of writers for that network.
Jeez.
I remember one time going through it with the head of Current, John Litvak, who we all knew. And we loved him as well.
I told that fucker to stop smoking every day, cigarette after cigarette.
I know. But
shut up, Rob. Just because I have an occasional cigarette, you looked at me with disdain. Fuck you, Rob. But Rob, you care about me though, Rob, right?
Yep.
Okay, we would go through like writers. Like I remember we were like trying to staff season two, and he'd be like, no, not approved, not approved. And I was like, God damn it. Look in that book for our names. And he goes, we're not approved either. So.
That's great. That's great. It's all right.
Yeah.
Sometimes you gotta look outside the box, my friend.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we sold it in September. Well,
yeah, but they didn't want to hear it first. So we're going to Warner Brothers, to WB as a courtesy. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
The whole plan was to sell it to Fox. We were all about selling it to Fox. And the head of Fox, a woman called Gail Berman, who went on to do the OC and Buffy and a bunch of shows, her whole thing was about love triangles and relationship triangles, which you look at Smallville, it's all about triangles, because we were designing the show
For her. So we pitched it to Fox. We only pitched to Fox and the WB. We go to Fox in the morning. Pitch goes great. They essentially want it in the room. So we go in the afternoon. We're going to the WB and Peter goes.
Peter Roth.
They know who he is now. He basically says, this is a courtesy. Let's just go in and do it. And we went in and we were pitching Suzanne Daniels.
Why don't you say, look, you can't, unless you already knew it was sold to Fox.
No, but I think for us, we were like, great, we have one in the bag. So,
you didn't care.
So the pressure's off.
Oh,
so,
I know how that goes.
Yeah, so we go in.
And it'd been pretty clear they didn't want it. They told us they didn't want it.
Well, they from the log line.
Yeah.
They heard Superman in high school, and they're like, we're not interested.
So you're fearless at this point.
So we go in, and it's a really well-worked-out pitch. And so we go in and we start pitching.
Also, we're all wearing like these Superman t-shirts over our shirts. Remember that? Peter was wearing it over his shirt and tie.
Yeah, dark. I do remember. Yeah. It was a little
it was
weird.
Like, yeah.
Joe Davola, like
yeah.
all of us.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we go in and pitch it and you can see Suzanne in the room slowly going, holy shit, this is a really good idea. And by the end, she goes, that's a great pitch. So it's like in the room, you could sort of see her going, wow, this is not what I thought it was going to be.
And as writers, you can tell if a pitch is going well or badly, just by people's reactions.
So you had a bidding war.
So we pitch it there. We leave. It seemed to go very well. And Peter came out and said, I think we're still going to Fox. And then it's radio silence for like 4 days while they're negotiating. The Fox executives are calling us and we like, look, guys, we think it's going to you. And then, you know, it's like a papal conclave. Suddenly it was like the doors open and Peter's like, we're selling it to the WB. They're going to give us, you know, 13. And we always thought it should go to the WB. Like,
I don't remember it being picked up for 13. I thought it was one, just the pilot.
It was basically, unless the pilot sucked, they weren't going to.
Yeah, but it was still, we're going to bet on ourselves. Remember that?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So you went with them.
So we went with the WB.
We were delighted, but it wasn't our decision. It was we were told after the fact.
It was the studios doing all of that. But I remember Suzanne Daniels wrote a book later and said Smallville was the best pitch he ever heard.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now the biggest challenge was coming. You know, you sold the script. You think that was the hardest challenge. The biggest challenge is actually getting these actors to play these legendary roles and to make the show pop.
Well, the nice thing was we sold the project in September of 2000. And most pilots, you don't start casting until you have the script, which means you start casting in January. they were like Chiracasting director, write sides. Sides are scenes from the episode that you're going to use.
Yeah, I didn't get an episode. I got
sides.
3 pages.
Yeah, that's what we had. So we were writing the script as, you know, we wrote these sides and we started auditioning people starting in October. And we turned the script in at Christmas, basically.
By the way, those side scenes are probably the best scenes in the show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was the fencing scene.
That was the fencing scene.
Yeah. The fencing scene. It was the graveyard scene. And
with,
it was
with Lana and Clark.
And it was the Chloe Pete scene.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You cast Clark first, right?
No. So
I don't remember who was cast
first. The plan was actually we were going to cast Clark first and cast around it. But then in December,
we did Universal Casting. We had casting directors all over the country doing casting calls.
How many?
We had New York, LA, Toronto, Vancouver, London.
Casting for all these characters. Casting
for all of them. Mostly frankly looking for Clark, Lana, Lex, like those were the primary ones. And then in December of 2000, we got this tape from Vancouver. So
it's, you know, video cassettes.
Yeah, it's video cassettes.
So we had a whole box of video cassettes all over all these auditions around the country.
I still have VHS tapes. I didn't hear, don't I?
And we had, and it was Kristen Kreuk.
She was the first one.
She did the scene.
Was it a self-tape or
it
not?
It was, no. Heike and...
oh, yeah.
They did it.
Heike in Vancouver,
Yeah. And said, she's amazing. You should see it. And we're like, okay. And we looked at it. And it was, again, like crappy VHS tape in a,
but it was enough. Room.
She was great. We were like, we need to get her now.
Then Clark. Yeah.
Then Clark.
Because he was a model and he had been on Chasing Amy. Not Chasing Amy. Regarding Amy.
No, it was
Judging Amy.
That's what
Judging,
it was.
Regarding.
No.
Yeah.
And he'd been in a Judd Apatow.
Yeah, in Undeclared.
Right.
But we had every, like, Jared Padalecki and Jensen Ackles and...
Who was the closest to getting him?
Jensen. When we went into the network, it was Tom and Jensen.
And isn't that funny? Jensen became a recurring character for a couple seasons, and that playing the high school coach, which was ridiculous because he looked great. But no, he was great. And then he went off to get a series called Supernatural. And I remember going, directed by Nutter.
David Nutter.
Right, of course. And then you're like, Supernatural. Hey, you know, whatever.
I know.
And then it's 15 seasons.
Yes. I know. But here's the best part there is because he was shooting in Vancouver. It was season 4. And they got the pilot and they shot the pilot of Supernatural in Los Angeles. And he would give Tom a hard time, like, hey, the show gets picked up. I'm shooting in Los Angeles. The minute the show gets picked up,
Vancouver.
15 years later.
It happened to me too with Impastor. It's like all of a sudden, like years later, they're like, we're going to film in Vancouver. I'm like, what? Not that I don't love Vancouver. Okay, so who is the hardest to cast?
Lex Luthor.
Lex.
We told you that. You know that story.
You know I know that.
Lex Luthor.
How honest to God, with a gun to your head, how many people auditioned for this role?
Oh, 500.
Oh my God, so many. So
many.
And
you saw every tape?
We saw every tape.
And who was up for it that you were like, he's pretty good?
Well, there was
Anson Mount.
Anson Mount,
but
Zach Levy,
Zach Levi.
So Zach Levi, actually, we took he was great. So we took him into the network, which is like, this is our choice. And I remember you always got to get a couple of people into the network, but everyone,
it's so terrifying.
Peter Roth loved him. We all loved him. So we took him into. They had this bungalow on the Warner Brothers lot.
I remember
the WB. So we went in there. I remember talking to Zach, saying, "You know, this can change your life. You know, this is going to be life changing."
Oh, why'd you do that?
Well, no, but I think he said it to me. Like, just, he gets into the audition room, and literally, it is the worst thing we've ever seen. Starts to cry, and it's just like, what happened?
Crying? Oh, crying as Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And it just the audition just went sideways.
Did he think it went great?
No.
I never forget. We were standing outside the bungalow, watching him walk away, realizing he completely blown it, and just like, and then we just sat turned to each other, like, what the hell is going to happen to that guy?
Did you feel bad?
Yeah. Devastated.
Because he's
a nice guy, and he's a great actor.
And he's a great actor, and look, he's had a great career.
Dude, I just had an audition where I go in there, and people go, did you nail it? Did you hit a home run, a grand slam? I got maybe a double.
Well, no, but that's the thing.
You never know. No. It's just like how you feel that day. It's like you guys in a pitch.
Yeah.
You can crush it, or you can go like, I don't know, the nerves got me, or I was a little bit, I wasn't articulate enough. I looked a little bit like I wasn't sure of myself. There's so many things that can go wrong.
And it was Dee Dee Bradley who said, you guys should take a second look at Michael.
Well, that's what we already seen you because you had
Wait a minute. You had a cold.
You had a cold.
No. This is the truth of the story. I swear to God, and I told this story. The first time my agents kept going, Smallville. And I go, ugh, I don't want to do a series about a young... It's the WB. The WB has a bunch of shitty shows. I don't want to... Not that they're shitty. I don't want to say... But fine. They're not. Just they're just young and light and soap opera-ish. And I was like, I was doing comedies.
Well, it was
like,
Dawson Creek at that point.
But I hadn't had huge success. Yeah. I did like Urban Legend, a show called Zoe that wasn't successful. So In my head, I just was like, yeah, I don't want to do this. And so I really half-assed the audition.
Yeah.
I just didn't give a shit. I remember not knowing my lines. I just didn't care.
Right.
And for some reason, I don't know what happened, but was it Dee Dee Bradley? It was another casting director too.
Yeah, but it was Dee Dee who told us to take a second look.
Oh, it was Dee Dee.
And
so,
and what was interesting was, and by that point, like we literally
We were like a week away from shooting the thing, so we had to just like the pivotal role.
Yeah.
So we were all freaking out, basically. And I was already in Vancouver
with
David Nutter prepping. So it was getting down to the wire, and I was in L.A., and I think that's when you came in.
You came in.
I didn't come to you.
You did.
No, hang on.
Okay.
I remember I came in again with nobody there.
You may have all I can tell you is I was in a room with Mike Tolan, and
he was another executive producer.
Executive producer, and you came in, and Dee Dee was like, had the camera set up, and this is when again the video cameras are kind of big.
And I told her to,
and she's like, oh, you need to be here and here, and you're like, no, I'm moving around, and we're like, follow him around. So
she goes, it's going to take me a few minutes to get everything you're read. I'm like, I want to sit, I want to get up, I want to do these things.
Yeah,
I asked them what 500 other guys were doing wrong. I wanted to know from you guys, and they asked you, I guess, and you said, we want him to have charisma, we want him to have a sense of danger.
We
want him to be smart or calculating or show a little bit of edge.
Yeah.
So I wrote, you know what, I'm going to be dangerous here, I'm going to be funny here, whatever. And I circled those areas, and I go, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
And I went in there, and it was one of those things like you didn't have a fear because you knew Fox was... they're going to buy it. So even if whatever happened. So you had no fear. I went in. It was one of those few auditions where I went in and I didn't care.
Yeah.
And it felt like so freeing.
And you were great.
But that was it. And they wanted him to test me. And I was like,
well, here's what happened there. Cause I heard this story.
I said,
Tom,
rewind the tape.
But then this is the other side of the story. So Miles comes back. We show him the tape. We're all like,
oh, and Peter Roth's there as well. And he literally says, he's looking at the tape.
We took it up to his office.
Oh,
yeah.
I saw it first.
You saw it first.
And thought, this is the guy.
We're like, this is the guy. So we say to Peter, we got the guy. We go up to his office. And it's the same thing. It's like humor, charisma, blah, blah, blah.
No, but he's literally standing in front of the TV and he's looking at you.
Yeah.
And then he says, oh, there it is. There's the danger.
Exactly right.
And we knew it was like, okay, great.
And then we're like, we want to take him to the network. And I think it was actually Peter. I'm sure they called and said, will you come into the network? You know, and Peter was like, just send them the tape.
And that's what, you know, what's funny is I was too scared.
And Jordan Levin loved you.
So, I love Jordan.
And by the way, it was one of those things, like once everybody saw the tape, it was done.
Funny is I said to my agent, he says, I go, listen, tell them to rewind the tape. I can't go back in. He goes, what do you mean? They'll never do this. This is one of their biggest shows. I go, I'll never be that good again.
You were.
In that room.
No, I know.
No, exactly.
For some reason, it was a bad decision, but it was a good decision. But I don't recommend that to anyone. It was a lucky thing.
No, because we sent them the tape thinking, oh God, if they're going to ask him to come in, and Jordan called and said he's great, hire him.
Lightning in the bottle. Jordan loved you.
Yeah.
So it was like
that was terrifying. Yeah. That was the most terrifying. Do you remember the first day? Or I think it was the first day where we were in the 12-foot deep tank, water tank.
Yes.
Ooh. And I was so scared because they put me down there and they put weights on my body and they put the mask on so I could breathe in the water. I'm like,
that was the last day, wasn't it?
No, I think that was
that the last day?
Yeah, the first day we came up, we recorded you shaving your head.
Oh, that was, do we have that somewhere?
You must. I think you recorded it.
I think I do have that
somewhere. You recorded it.
But I remember, you always think you're going to get fired. You always think you're going to, and I had done some other shows and this was the first time in my life, because my father, I always tell the story, he's like, what do you mean you're doing an independent movie? So you're not doing a real movie? You're doing a short film? No, that's not a real film, a short. So he always thought, like, what are you doing acting? Get out of this profession. He wasn't the most supportive. So when I saw the opening of the pilot, David Nutter brought me in because I was doing ADR sound for the, you know, and he said, well, would you like to see the opening? And I go, sure. And I could not believe what I had seen. And I walked out and I called my parents and I said, this is going to be a hit. people are going to maybe recognize me finally in my life. And they go, what do you mean? I go, no, I just know it. That's, and they never heard me say that before.
Right.
And so it just, it was one of those, it was lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying because I, when you walk on set, the production design, I'd never seen anything like it. And, you know, that whole town in the opening blowing up, you know, with the meteor shower and the, it was just, and the way it was shot and the, you know, everything came together. People always say the actors made the show, or they'll say, you know, the way it was, it's so important to understand that without the writers, without the creation and a vision, and without all the people they hire around it, and if those people, any of those people aren't good at what they do, and, you know, that the DP doesn't light the right thing, or it is, everything has to come together to make it
yeah,
so.
Yeah, and then it's alchemy.
Yeah, it is alchemy.
You can have the same group of people make something else, and it's crap. It's the idea, it's the script, it's that amazing combination of actors, and then the team behind it in terms of production, the director. So it is, but it's bizarre how it's just that special moment. And then it's also the timing, you know, because we came out, you know, one of the first superhero shows, Lois and Clark had been the last iteration of Superman. And then critics were like, eh, nothing. And then 9/11 happened. And that the show premiered a month after 9/11. And that really changed everything in terms of people's perception of the show as a celebration of what America could be and is. So that we'd really leaned into the Americana of Smallville as a notion in production design and costuming and the sort of color and the beauty of what it is to be America, or people's imagination of what America is. So that really just was what the country needed at this moment when that happened. And I think it's really important to remember that moment. That's,
and not only that, yeah, it was, I think that's really poignant. And I also think that, you know, the WB hadn't really done anything that was, had the dichotomy of, you know, they had the shows that were kind of like all pretty and nice, but this had this sort of darkness to it where you'd see Clark and you'd see his father and his family, this all-American family and this love and affection. And then you'd see
the Luthers
and like what, you know, the backstory to all the darkness. And that's what I think the both those two together just kind of created something really special.
Well, it was multi-generational. And I think that's really
and it was adding complexity to
the mythology
to superheroes in terms of that idea, which is radical at that moment. There hadn't been anything; there'd been X-Men, but the idea of adding depth and emotion to these people that you'd read in a comic book was kind of ludicrous. And what's happened now is that we sort of swung the other direction. That critics are now like, all they want comic book movies to be is funny and sort of banal, which is sort of where they always put it. It's back into that same slot.
Yeah. It just feels like nowadays, I'm not bashing movies. Maybe it's just because I'm old. I used to say to my father, oh, it's because you're old, or my grandfather. It's like, you hate everything. You hate music. Am I becoming that? Do we become that? But I don't think that's true. I feel like, for me, like horror movies, you know, horror movies really scared me, and they don't make
You really enjoyed Us?
Huh? I didn't say it was Us that I didn't like. Did you read the tweet?
Yes.
It just infuriates me sometimes because, look, I love seeing people's success. But don't you think that a lot of movies, it's just the same movie made over and over?
Yes, and I think also there's a lemming-like attitude to popular culture that if all the critics will love something, but it's like, well, really?
Yeah, it's the Rotten Tomatoes effect.
Thank you, because you probably agreed with my tweet then. Yeah, maybe I was a little too hard.
No, because there's a lack of honesty. That no one can be honest about what they think.
They're afraid to say what they think. Here's what they should do. Here's what Rotten Tomatoes should do. Tell me if I'm wrong. If you give a movie an A, Miles, Al, Rob, if you give a movie an A, it probably means that I'd see that movie again. That's how I judge it. If I want to give a movie an A, I'd see that again. It was so good, I'd see it again. How many of these movies are given 90, 95, 97% that you want to see over and fucking over again?
Have you seen Cold War? So it's like that and Roma and these movies, which are sort of super worthy, but actually are boring as fuck. So why do people going to sit there and watch this stuff that gets 100%? It's like, they're boring.
Sorry.
So,
and then you see the schism between the Rotten Tomatoes critics and the Cinema Score, which grades what audiences think of movies, which is also fascinating.
Yeah.
But I think the horror movie thing is like fascinating in terms of what critics think a good horror movie is. I mean, Hereditary is a great independent movie. It's not a horror movie. By any stretch.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a horror movie than Us. Oh, more of a horror movie than most of the horror movies. It had some scares, which make it a horror movie.
It had some shocks.
Don't call yourself a horror movie if it's a horror comedy.
Right.
Don't call Shaun of the Dead a horror movie. It's hilarious and great, but it's not scary. So I have these problems with, like, you know.
What was the last scariest movie you saw then?
the scariest, like, the, you know, look, It Follows, Insidious.
I love It Follows.
It Follows was genius. Yep. It was original. It was dark. It was just like something I hadn't seen. I watch a lot of indie
and it's movies. So simple.
So simple. And I think that the success stories, if you look at them like The Strangers, they're simple. And that's what I want to do. I want to make a horror movie that's just simple. Keep it simple. Something that's relatable that could happen to anybody. That's what success. You do these giant movies, these commercial movies that are just CGI'd out the ass. I get really frustrated with it.
Yeah, interesting.
What do you think about all the superhero movies nowadays? DC and Marvel. Do you feel like it's one of those guys? Because you don't want to sound like one of those guys. Like, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, back in our day.
Yeah, but do you think it's oversaturated? Do you think?
You know, you would think so.
Or give people what they want.
But it's not like my son is 15. He watches all of the CW shows. He loves the movies. So, I mean, for him, they're great. I mean, right. I look at it and I go, this is all stuff we did 20 years ago. You know, I sort of feel like, you know, we
well, it's so weird, isn't it? My daughter is 13, loves it as well.
But yeah. Hang on, here's the difference. When I was a kid, Raiders of the Lost Ark came out and I had to wait another 6 months to a year for another movie like that to come out. And that was exciting.
Yeah.
Now it's every fucking month there's the big ass blockbuster.
Well, this is
I'm not putting it down, I'm just saying.
No, but it's part of it is distribution changed. So, you know,
I think as Michael said, it's giving people what they want and people's it's insatiable. You think when's it gonna stop? That's why I think it's like a religion now that people it's like chapters of a fucking Bible that people need and feel that this urgency to figure out I need to know what happens next. It's like it's actually
but when are they going
to
run out?
I don't think they are.
You think they can continue with these stories forever?
If you can make Ant-Man, if Captain Marvel can make $1 billion,
would it go wrong?
They can turn
or Ant-Man or you know the other ones like Thor. I mean, how does Thor have 3 movies? It's just like it's impossible to imagine.
I mean, they've done. I mean, again,
kudos.
We've known Kevin Feige for a long time.
Genius. Yeah.
Honestly, it's like amazing.
I just want more horror movies. I want good horror movies.
It's a very hard genre.
Yeah.
It's a very hard.
Because it's like, how can you add something original to that genre? That hasn't been trod before. It's very difficult.
You don't, here's the reality. If I was a studio head, don't hire big stars. You do not need big stars for a horror movie. Get nobodies. Pay them nothing. Make a movie. I mean, pay them enough, you know. Make a movie for $3 million with a great script, get the best writers. We don't need to make it for 50 or 30 or 20 with tons of CGI and find me good scripts and get the best writers. Things that are relatable, things that people fear, you know, being home alone at night, you know, the boogeyman, the Babadook, things
like
that.
I like the Babadook.
Yeah, so anyway, that's, I don't want to get off on that. But look, you gave me a career. You gave all of us a career. Without you guys, and this opportunity, I wouldn't be here. I you know, I'd probably be doing comedies and I'd be doing it, but who knows? I never thought, look, I always did plays.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny as people always say it. You both have always said it. Don't forget you're a dramatic actor. And I'm like, I tell you this
all
because
the
I think
time.
Always I was the goofy little kid that I'm like funny and I'm this and I'm like, I don't know, really?
No, I think that's the strange thing about people's psychology. It's like you're an amazing dramatic actor who's work has been, you know, celebrated for 20 years almost in terms of on Smallville. So it's like, why haven't you done Broadway? Why haven't you done more theater? Why haven't you done more movies? It's like one of those things that you have that, because I think you've been fighting against doing that. You've been like, I'm a comedian. I want to be a comedian.
You're one of the few people I know, like most comedians want to be taken as serious dramatic actors, and you're the dramatic actor that wanted to be the comedian.
But I was always a goofball kid, the guy, you know, growing up, always making jokes, always doing impressions, always making people laugh. And, you know, before Smallville, I did Sorority Boys, and it didn't
do that well.
But, like, Disney was trying to make a deal with me, and I was off to start making comedies. But once I shaved my head, my career completely changed.
Right.
And for 7 years, really, that was Smallville. And I don't regret it for a minute. No way. But it definitely put my I think if it wasn't for Smallville, I don't think I probably would have. Who knows if I would have ended up doing drama.
Right.
It was really hard for me to. People say action, and I'm being very serious the whole time. So if you notice, when
it's always behind the scenes is always hilarious.
Behind the scenes,
they're
it's
hilarious.
Just like me laughing, being an idiot, and then action.
But the one thing I'll say, Michael, is that, and it's something obviously having done like 300 hours of television now, is like, you know, we've worked with people who are real actors, and you are a real actor. You never arrived on set without being prepared. You knew your lines. You'd goof around until the very last second.
Did it piss you
someone
off?
Says action and you fuck you were on.
Didn't piss us off. That was always
you,
good.
And you had all those speeches to learn and you delivered time and again with nuance.
You deliver more misinformation about Alexander the Great than anybody.
I didn't
anybody.
Know what I was saying.
But that's fine. But you delivered it with such belief. But you guess what? It looks effortless, but clearly you'd spent the night as any good actor learning your lines and knowing your shit. And that's what you, and that is actually something that's rare, that you never took it for granted, that you were serious about your craft. And that, guess what? It shows on screen. You can see the craftsmanship and your dedication in the performance. It's not just like, you just don't turn that on. It's something is.
That means a shit ton. Well, thank you.
And we work with some amazing actors.
Yeah,
you have. And they all have that sense of, I think, duty and responsibility. And they realize that that's their love. That's their
professionalism
passion.
And like, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's when we look at everyone on Smallville, we have a no assholes rule. If someone is a dick, in any regard, writer, actor, director, anything, they don't stay working for us for long, because we love to have an atmosphere of creativity and friendship and warmth. And I think we lucked out with the Smallville cast because they were great people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's that's a rare thing. And as we've gone on, that was a very rare thing. We had and everyone on that show, we were young and they had incredible fame very, very quickly. And they, you know, that can make people crazy. You know, that's a big thing to you see yourself on the cover of Mad Magazine or Rolling Stone or TV Guide.
Did you see that I have it in my bathroom? Yeah. You saw that. You like that. Yeah. Huh? That was my favorite thing.
And also TV, you could literally become an overnight success. Whereas movies, you make movies and it takes time for it to come. I remember Owen Wilson talking about this. It's like the movies are in the can. You're making another movie. So it's a little bit of a slower build in movies.
No, did he say, it's more like a slower build?
Wow, he said, man, it's a slower build.
I don't know, it's really great. Yeah. It's like, I love working with you. I don't know. It's like, Jackie's real aggressive. I need a stunt double.
That's very good. Very good.
Look, you went on, you keep creating amazing things. You guys have Into the Badlands on AMC. It's the fourth season. It's out now.
Yes,
on AMC.
Yeah.
And
you can catch up on Netflix.
How do you continue to push the envelope? How do you make, because if season one's great, which it was, how do you make season two better? Is that always the idea of how do we just make everything better? Because you don't have really Freak of the Week like you did in Smallville. Again, people don't understand, like 22 episodes a year, they called it Freak of the Week.
Yeah.
But to defend writers, if you're writing 22 episodes a week, 10 months a year, if you have a handful of great ones, a handful of good ones, and some media, you're not going to have perfection. Nowadays, they make 10 episodes on most TV shows, 10.
And they better be great.
And they're all written before the season starts. They better be great. So how do you do that with Into the Badlands?
Well, I mean, it was interesting making television in the Smallville era of 22, which is exactly, we say that all the time.
That wasn't just say that fucking pissed me off, this whole Freak of the Week.
I know. When I said it, I go,
absolutely fucking pissed me off. Well,
tell me that. Tell me why it pissed you off.
This guy, Clark Kent, aka Superman, has superpowers. Who the fuck is he gonna fight? What do they want him to do?
Yeah,
solve the local, like, you know, shoplifting crime at the thrifty mart. I mean, it's literally want that guy doing something.
I want to see the rage, Miles.
This is where the rage comes out.
But you're right, because it's like the media shower hit. This is the perfect idea for people to have some kind of powers, which Clark has to stop them. Otherwise, you're right. He's fighting normalcy.
Yeah. So it's like Buffy fought fucking vampires every week. Nobody seemed to have
people
a
always
with that.
Have a problem with everything. Yeah. You know, they always have he's fighting the bug guy. You're right. Who is he supposed to fight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this is the thing where we did have orders from on high the first five episodes to keep repeating the pilot. That we had to keep reading because everyone was afraid no one would understand the show. That was the big fear that everyone at the network and the studio, you guys, you don't understand. No one's going to know what he is.
And an avid viewer at that time watched 1 in 4 episodes of a show. So they wanted to make sure that people, as Miles said, that
so I watched the first 10 episodes with my 13-year-old daughter recently, right? And yeah, I think, I was amazed how big they were, the episodes, like ridiculous. Like, I can't believe we did that and how good they still
were.
And
it was shot on film.
But that sort of the repetitive nature of those episodes, I get the criticism there, but the whole notion of like, they do Freak of the Week, is like, give me a break.
So Into the Badlands.
Yeah.
What can we expect this season?
Well, this season, it's the last season, so you can expect a conclusion.
This is it.
This is
it. Are people pretty upset about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think they are. I think people, it's one of those shows, unlike Smallville, I would say it's a very acquired taste. And when people love the show, they love it. But, and I think the fans are incredibly passionate. That's, I mean, you know how toxic Twitter can be. If you want to feel good about yourself, for us, it's like go on the Into the Badlands Twitter feed. People love the show.
Of course.
You know, it's like mall
I think that's with every show. Yeah. It's like people, you know, you could sit here and talk about any show on television, yeah. and there's those people that are passionate about it.
Yeah.
And those are the people that make the show yeah. successful.
And I mean, for us, it was like, it was a huge swing. It was not based on anything. And the fact that AMC supported the show, gave us the money to make the show, frankly, gave us the money and left us alone. Like they never had more freedom. And we were able to make this insane show for 5 years, and the show has a conclusion. So if you start watching the show, it feels like, you know, when you get
and
to
he
the
had
end.
Nick Frost, the wonderful Nick Frost Nick came Frost on for a couple amazing. Seasons.
Yeah, he came on in season two,
right?
And he's fantastic. That was one of the things. One of
he
the criticisms.
Is amazing.
So funny, so good.
He's so good, and his his instinct is. We actually said it's a lot like you, which is just like all of his choices are just real and great.
And like, they elevate it. Whatever yeah. his maturity has, he just elevates
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. Great.
And you believe, you know, you believe what he's saying. He fits into the world. And for us, you know, the first season, you know, the criticism, which we took, which is like the show feels very serious. And, you know, Miles and I and David Dobkin, who did the first three episodes, were like, how did the three guys who did Shanghai Nights make such a serious show? And so we wanted to open it up. And, you know, thankfully, Nick came into our lives.
Brought some comedy.
Yeah.
Brought some, just mixed it up a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah. And he's great. And it yeah. just, and it literally opened up the show in a way that we never really.
And if you don't know Nick Frost, I mean, Shaun of the Dead, I mean, the guy's been around. He's just a hilarious yeah. Actor. The book. What yes. made you want to write a book?
This was a long, long time project. It's literally a hobby. We had this idea, I think, in 2010. And it was, interestingly, looking at Indiana Jones. The thing we loved about Indiana Jones was that he was a guy with an incredibly specific, you know, skill set and career. He's an archaeologist. And I'm sure, like all of us, you were like, I don't know what an archaeologist does. It doesn't feel like an adventure thing, but then you see Indiana Jones, you know, like he's in a classroom and now he's doing adventures and he's taking a punch. And all of those movies started with an archaeology thing. So we were like, we want something specific like that. So we came up with this idea for a character named David Tolan, who's the first director of preservation for the Library of Congress's National Film Archives. And in this first book, it's set in 1961, a canister of film comes over the Berlin Wall, which has not been up that long. And the CIA brings it to David, who is a former Korean War vet. So he wanted to get away from war. He's literally in an office in the Library of Congress restoring movies. And then he restores this canister. And films back in the day were nitrate, which meant if they weren't kept at a proper temperature, they would start to deteriorate. He's able to restore it. And without giving anything away, it sets up a huge conspiracy that then sets them on a globe-trotting adventure. So the idea for us, we initially did it as a movie or wanted to do it as a movie. And then we realized it's period, it's globe-trotting. If it's not Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise or Leonardo DiCaprio, nobody's ever making this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's called double exposure.
Yeah. Double exposure, right.
It's been a really fun experience just to do a different medium.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you guys are, amazing. You're amazing creators, amazing writers, amazing guys. Once you get to know you. No, I'm kidding. But seriously, you've done your body of work. I mean, it speaks for itself. And you show that hard work really does pay off because, you know, from the beginning of this interview, you talked about you write every day. You challenge yourself every day. You guys wrote a book to try and break up the monotony maybe of writing screenplays and TV shows, which to most people would be enough. But it's never enough. You are insatiable, right? I think that's a good word to describe both you guys. And I have a feeling, you know, if I live long, you'll be around writing projects, doing things. And I'll be like, oh, yeah, they didn't put me in that. I was fucking
it's not bad. For lack of trying, by the way.
We have tried, haven't we?
we're doing this. Life, look, it's a very long life.
Yes.
You know, it's true. Who knows what will happen? I'll be 47. You guys are right around there.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
We're all nearly the same age. Whether we work in a year together from now or 5 years, 10 years, I love you guys.
We love you too.
Yeah, I really think that this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Wait a minute. That was from a movie, wasn't it? What's your favorite movie, Miles?
My favorite movie, I love the movie Heat.
Really? Mm-hmm. Michael Mann?
Michael Mann. It's my part of my favorite
filmmaker.
You
love that movie.
I do love that. I love the movie Drive as well.
I didn't see Drive.
Oh, my God, Michael.
But Michael Mann, Heat, there's that guy Ted Levine's in that. He was the guy from Silence of the Lambs who was like, Oh, wait.
Tom Noonan. That
guy? She a great big fan person? It puts a lotion. So I watch. So what's funny is about that guy is I saw him in Silence of the Lambs, and one time I was watching the TV and the mute button was on, and I look at it and I go, "Hey, that's the dude from Silence of the Lambs. I want to see how he really talks." And I pressed play, and he goes, "Hey, can I get a beer around here?" Oh my God, he talks like that. But okay, what's your favorite, Al?
All That Jazz.
All That Jazz.
Yeah.
That is completely different than what I thought you'd say. You love musicals, though.
I do.
Al is a big theater kid.
I do.
Well, look, this has been a real treat. I hope you guys will come back. This is a great part of having the creators of Smallville here, friends of mine, in my house. It's a real treat.
Thank you, Michael.
So thank you for allowing me to Wait, how do I say it?
Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you. Yes, we are three-way.
Both of you. All right, guys. What a treat. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone's senior writer, Brian Hyatt.
Now, here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.